Welcome to episode 4 of The Genomics Life. My goal is to give you some behind-the-scenes stories of the people, their innovations, and exciting work in the field of genomics. In this episode, I talk to Deanna Church. Deanna is currently Senior Director of Mammalian Applications at Inscripta. Previously, she was Senior Director of Applications at 10x Genomics, Senior Director of Genomics and Content at Personalis. And prior to that, she was a scientist at NCBI, where she led NCBI's team in the Genome Reference Consortium, and she helped improve human, mouse, and zebrafish assemblies, and was part of the group involved in releasing GRC-H38, which is the Human Genome Reference Assembly. Deanna is an expert on highly informative reference genomes, single-cell applications, genomics, and bioinformatics. I am excited for you to listen to her episode, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, and welcome to The Genomics Life. I am here today with Deanna Church, and she is going to give a little intro, and we'll go from there.
Great. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for having me here. So what I am doing currently, so I am the Senior Director of Mammalian Applications at a company called Inscripta. So we're a pretty young company right now, and what our focus is trying to build tools for the genomic space. And in particular, we're really interested in building tools to help accelerate genome editing. Mm-hmm. We're about to release a new product later this year, or about to actually ship a new product later this year called Onyx, that is a benchtop platform that allows for the creation of libraries in either E. coli or yeast that consist of up to 10,000 variants and a single library. So you can really think about doing large scale engineering followed by phenotyping to understand, you know, gene function, do protein synthesis. But this is sort of my first foray into the genome editing field. Prior to that, I'd more really been in the genome reading field. So thinking about doing genome assemblies, variant detection, moved a little bit into functional genomics when I was at 10x Genomics. So kind of excited about being able to do something new now.
Something new. And this is CRISPR-based?
This is CRISPR-based. We have our own proprietary nuclease that we developed called MAD7. And so that is part of the reagents that we provide with the instrument.
Okay. So that's the like secret part that is what's behind what you're doing, or is that just like a special extra thing?
So that's actually not really the secret part per se. So we had developed our own nuclease and we released MAD7 to the world freely available and unencumbered. Okay. A little over a year ago, in fact, because one of the things that we really care about is we think the tools to do genome editing need to be readily accessible to the world. Mm-hmm. So we have our own enzyme engineering group that works on developing these kind of nucleases, because, you know, everyone in the CRISPR field talks a lot about a small number of nucleases, but there's really a wide group of these. And mm-hmm. I think the talk from David in Chris Mason's lab really demonstrated how little we know about the space of CRISPRs out in the world.
And there's so much more that's possible.
And so we really want to enable our customers to do the work that they want to do, and we want mm-hmm. to make it accessible. So yeah. So MAD7 is an important part, but there's a lot. I would say really the key is the instrument that we've made. So this is a benchtop instrument that really helps with the cell management. So you get your reagents and your microfluidic consumables and put those on the deck of the instrument with your cells.
Okay.
And the instrument really helps sort of level out a lot of the discontinuities of biology, right? Like mm-hmm. once you start manipulating the cells, a lot of non-linearity can happen. And so what that instrument does is really help handle that and help improve the editing performances tremendously. Okay.
Awesome. So it's a lot of things. It's not anyone.
It's right.
The instrument. It's the process. It's this ability to go in and just make all these edits and go from there.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I think the thing I learned this both at 10x and now at Inscripta is that to make these products, mm-hmm. and I mean, it's hard to argue the impact that 10x has had on the industry. And
absolutely.
I think we're hoping to have the same impact. Is that you need to bring together people with a lot of diverse skill sets. Mm-hmm. You know, I think when we think about attacking these problems and doing large scale genome engineering, Some problems we can tackle with biology. Some problems we have to tackle with engineering. Mm-hmm. Some problems we have to tackle with code. And so it's one of the things that I really like about working in this space is I get to work with people from a lot of different disciplines, because that's really what it takes to move the field forward.
Totally agree with you there. Okay, so can we backtrack to when you were younger?
Okay.
And like as a child, were you interested in science? Like how did you gravitate into this field?
So when I was a kid, I used to love to read. And I, you know, kind of like, I don't know that I like science necessarily more than anything else. I liked a lot of different things. But I would say when I got to junior high school, in high school, I started doing science fairs. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that really got me hooked. Like even in high school, I was really lucky I had the opportunity to work with someone who was a professor at one of the local colleges. His name was Mac Welford. So I got to kind of do this little supercharged science fair project, cool. which was kind of awesome. And that's really what got me in. And to the point that, you know, when I went to college the next year, I actually wasn't a science major. I was a liberal arts major, but I immediately went to the biology department and I found Dan Burke, who had just started his lab from Lee Hartwell's lab. He'd come from Lee Hartwell's lab, started his lab at UVA.
Where were you?
Oh, UVA. I was at UVA.
Right.
And so I worked for him for 4 years in the lab. So I got a lot of really hands-on experience while being able to take advantage of some of the other liberal arts curriculum at UVA to learn other stuff. So that was really kind of cool.
Yeah, I grew up in Charlottesville, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, I was living there probably when you were
in
college, I think.
You might have been, yeah.
Awesome. That's funny. Yeah, UVA is a great place to be able to do both a really high level of education there.
Yeah.
And yeah, so you did undergrad research the whole time?
I did. All 4 years I worked in the lab.
That's great. So then you knew when you graduated that was like your path?
So it's kind of funny. So I did know that that was what I wanted to do, but I didn't actually get into grad school my first go around.
Okay.
And so that actually turned out to be a great opportunity for me because I moved to Boston where I was eventually fortunate enough to get a job with a man named Alan Buckler, who at the time was a postdoc in David Hausman's lab. Nice. And then he moved over to MGH in Jim Buscella's group to start his own lab. And so I was his technician. And that's really what got me into genomics. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, so this was prior to there being a human genome assembly.
Yep.
Really even kind of just before, people were kind of talking about doing the Human Genome Project and there were some pilots, but nothing super serious yet. Mm-hmm. And Alan had developed a technique called exon trapping that was meant to do gene identification because it was largely a vector that had splice sites in it. So you could clone genomic DNA. And then if there was an exon in that genomic DNA you cloned in, you could splice it into the vector. So you could then detect coding sequence.
Nice.
And so we were using that to do gene identification before there was a reference assembly and trying to apply that to the problem of identifying genes implicated in disease. So we had started really working on Huntington's disease.
Oh, yeah. I have a very close family friend who has Huntington's in their family. I've always been interested in that.
Yeah, it was challenging because it was the first gene for which people had linkage, but it took so long to identify the underlying gene. And you know, I think part of it's, particularly at that time of genomics, it was really easy to fall in love with candidates. You could get your region of interest. You find your genes and you could kind of make a story for why every gene in that could be the candidate gene.
Yes.
And also the whole like triplet repeat disease mechanism was not really understood at that point.
You didn't really have the technology to go in and figure all that out.
Exactly. So it was a long slog, but we also got to work on quite a few other disease genes as well. Mm-hmm. So that's really what got me into genomics. So it turned out that not getting into graduate school actually was probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Right. That's awesome. So that was like was it the mid-90s?
No, that would have been the early 90s.
Early 90s.
A little bit older than you realize.
you look very young.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. But no, that would have been like 90 to 92.
Okay.
And then I did decide that I wanted to go to graduate school. So I applied to a few places. And I ended up at UC Irvine to work with John Wasmuth. And part of that was because I had worked with John and several people from his lab as part of the Huntington's Disease Project. Oh, wow. And at that point now, the Human Genome Project had really started. And so John's lab was the Chromosome 5 Genome Center. Mm-hmm. So I was working on doing genotype-phenotype correlations for humans, which at the actually still kind of hard to do, but at that time, super hard to do. So I was studying a disorder called Crudashaw, which is a developmental disorder that is associated with deletions of the short arm of chromosome 5. Mm-hmm. So the children who have this, they have a series of developmental disorders, but they also have a very characteristic cat-like cry.
Right.
And it is very striking. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of physical mapping, building bat clones that actually got fed into the Human Genome Project.
Yeah, I did bats.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I did bats.
Back in the day, that's right. Good old times.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was what my graduate work was.
That's awesome. And what did you find, like, at the end, like, your thesis, was there, what was your, like, you had mapped it pretty well at that point? You sequenced it?
What we found was that, A, the disorder was really more heterogeneous than people had realized. Uh-huh. And so we found we could do a lot of fine mapping and identify families that had pretty big deletions of chromosome 5, but did not have Crudashaw. We also had families, we had this one interesting family, and I was really sad that we never got to follow up on this family, but they had a very large translocation, inversion, mm-hmm. that involved part of the very end of chromosome 5. Mm-hmm. The family was all of normal intelligence, but the father who had the inversion as well as his two sons, they did not speak until they were 10 years old. Whoa. So they had this very, very delayed speech, uh-huh. but then caught up and were fine.
That's very interesting.
It is super interesting. And it turns out that, you know, one of the things that we found is that these kids with Crudashaw often also have speech delay. And in fact, one of the hypotheses that we were sort of putting forward is that, and I think this is a little bit more accepted now, is that some of these kids were not really as bad off as people thought, but because they couldn't speak,
right,
that it made people think that they were,
it's like an intelligence thing almost, because they couldn't speak or something.
Well, children with Crudashaw do have developmental delay, and they do have some degree of mental impairment, but I think it was amplified because of the speech delay, and so they weren't quite as impaired as people thought because of that.
I see. Yeah. So then in this family with this inversion, it was like a halfway onset of the disease almost?
Well, so I think what it allowed us to do was start thinking about how we could break down the phenotypes.
Yeah.
Because it was clear that different parts of the Crudashaw phenotype seemed to be coming from different parts of the short arm of chromosome 5, because most of the kids just have almost all of the short arm missing. And so
when you have some variation of that,
exactly,
you get some variation on that type of a disease.
Exactly. We were able to find families that had atypical deletions, so we could start fine mapping some of the phenotypes.
Right. That's awesome. And it also was very early in genomics. And so I don't think a lot of people know what it was like before the human genome was sequenced. Like, there were all these guesses as to how many genes we had.
Yes.
Like, we did not know that at that point.
Yes.
Like, these things, when you think about it today, we think we know everything. It's just mind-blowing to go back only 20 or 30 years to where we were.
Oh, yeah. I joke all the time about how I could take my thesis and probably do it in a month now.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the work we do in a day is what we would do in like 10 years back then.
Back in the day.
Back in the day of backs.
Well, and I think, you know, this is one of the things that I've really enjoyed about this conference, in fact, is that, you know, Barbara Wold, Rick Myers, Rick Wilson, like, there was a lot of historical perspective put on the work that we've been doing, right?
Yes.
Because we have a whole generation of scientists now who have grown up and they've never not known having a reference assembly or having single cell genomics or some of the things that we didn't have. And so seeing that historical perspective, I thought was fantastic to really think about where we came from, because, you know, that the limitations of technology at that point shaped how we thought about the genome and biology.
Yes.
And as technology has improved, we've had to rethink what that means.
Always. Yes.
And this meeting is very much a celebration of that, because this meeting is all about technology.
Yes. And just for our listeners, yes. Deanna is referring to AGBT, which is where we are right now on Marco Island at this meeting. And it's the 20th year that this meeting has taken place. So there have been some historic speakers here.
Yes.
So who've been in the field the whole time.
Oh, yeah. There are many people here who were at the first meeting 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever go to the GSAC meetings?
I did not go to the GSAC
meetings. I went to some of those. I didn't come to the early meetings for AGBT, but I used to go to GSAC back when I worked at Tiger.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. But I love this meeting. I love that it was kind of a spinoff or whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
to kind of break away from that meeting.
Inspired.
Yes, inspired. Okay, so at this point, you got in your PhD, and did you go to NIH after that, or what was your path right after?
No, so I decided, in fact, that I was done with human genetics because working on humans was too hard, and so I went to Canada. I was the reverse brain drain. And I did a postdoc in the lab of Janet Rossent, who is a luminary in the field of mouse developmental biology.
Okay.
One of the early leaders in pioneering the use of mouse embryonic stem cells. Her lab identified mouse trophoblastic stem cells.
Mm. Wow.
And so I decided I was going to work on mouse developmental biology.
Okay.
And we wanted to, and one of the things we wanted to do was to understand if we could apply some of the genomics techniques to really help in that field.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like a nice marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it was a little bit rough, partly because I picked a mouse mutant, because I was going to try and work on a mouse mutant in her lab, and it turned out to not be a very robust phenotype.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a little bit challenging.
Yeah.
I also developed what is possibly the worst mouse allergy
that
had been observed in her lab.
Really? Do you have like other pet allergies or animal?
I do, but my allergy profile has changed over the years. So at that time, I had hay fever and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it's not uncommon for people to become allergic to mice, because there is a protein in their urine that's highly antigenic.
Uh-huh.
And if there's one thing that mice do all the time, it's pee.
Everywhere.
It's everywhere. And it developed over time, but it really got to the point that I could go down to the mouse facility completely gloved, gowned, mm-hmm, respirator, everything, and still come up with hives.
Ooh,
or
bad.
I could stand next to somebody who'd been to the mouse room, and if they were wearing the same lab coat, I would start wheezing.
Oh my gosh.
That's
not sustainable.
It was not sustainable, and I was very happy that our lab was actually in the Mount Sinai Hospital. So there was an ER that was two floors above the mouse facility, but it still did not seem very sustainable. So at that point, and actually through connections that through Alan, I actually happened to know Mark Boguski, who at the time was at NCBI.
Mm-hmm.
And so they invited me down because they were looking for someone. So this was right about the time the human genome was going strong and they wanted to start the mouse genome project.
Okay. Yeah.
And so NCBI wanted to have somebody who knew the mouse community, knew, mm-hmm, mouse genetics, that could come in and help coordinate for that project. So it turned out to be very fortuitous that the timing was good. So I still didn't have to be in human genetics.
Yeah.
I'm still
mouse genetics,
doing mouse work, but at NCBI.
Not with the mice directly, yeah, with their DNA only.
That's right. So that's when I switched over to being purely bioinformatics.
Okay, I see. That makes sense.
Yeah.
You're like, that's it for the lab.
That's it for the lab. That's right. Well, and NCBI doesn't have a lab facility, so it really is.
Yeah, that's true.
Is really kind of isolated
data,
in that way.
Data, data.
Exactly.
Okay, awesome. So at NCBI then, I know you did a lot there, but where do you even start with what you did there and the time you were there?
So, you know, my time at NCBI was really great and I learned a ton.
Mm-hmm.
I think the being able to work on the mouse genome project was really kind of nice because, you know, being the first project, so the human project, human genome, was really hard because, A, it was this big international collaboration. We'd never done a genome that big before. We didn't really know how to do it. There was a little bit of a race, right? There was some time pressure to do some things.
Yes, quite the race.
And so, you know, I would say the mouse genome project was a little bit more low-key.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a collaboration, but not as big. The time pressures were a little bit different. And we could also learn from events that had happened with the human genome.
Correct.
Also, the fact that we were working with inbred strains was also useful. But, you know, so part of what I really tried to do with the mouse genome was take some of the work that had been done for human that was very manual, and I worked with a really talented database creator there, database developer there, and we started working on trying to automate this process of trying to build the mouse genome so that it was not quite as manual, because at that point in time, we still did an awful lot of manual review because we were still putting genomes together largely with bat clones.
Yep.
And so once we had put a lot of effort into actually doing this automation, it was about the time the human genome was also, like, the human genome project was finishing up. Mm-hmm. But we realized, I was at a meeting in Cambridge. It was a meeting on structural variation. And actually, this would have been a couple of years after the human genome project was done. And people were complaining about the fact that they were finding errors in the human genome. Mm-hmm. Because if you find, when you find these structural variants that aren't in any, every person you look at has the structural variant, it's not in the reference, it's a pretty good sign that maybe this is a problem.
Yeah.
But they had there was no mechanism for them to get it fixed. They didn't even know who to talk to about this.
Wow.
And so Ewan and I started talking about this because Ewan Burney was also at this conference. Mm-hmm. And we're like, you know, we really need to do something to think about how we keep the human genome moving forward, because we just put all this effort into it.
And the human genome was a mix of different people, right?
It was a mix of different people, but I mean, it's certainly hard to argue at this point that it is the underpinning of so much biology we do that we want it to be as robust as possible.
Yes, I agree for sure.
And
but how to represent that it's a mix of different people and how to also have it be halfway or like,
yeah,
but what else could you have done at the same time?
Well, I would say at that point, we weren't even really thinking about that representation.
Mm-hmm.
Because really what was sort of being presented to us at that point were really just the things that seemed to be frank errors.
Okay.
Now, we now understand in retrospect that the source of a lot of those errors was the fact that while the human genome is made up of several people, it's about 70% one individual.
Yes.
And this one individual is African American, and he's about 50% West African, 50% European. Mm-hmm. And there seemed to be a lot of structural variance between his two haplotypes. Yeah. And so a lot of the errors in the representation and the reference were because of these differences in his genome. Yeah.
But it was kind of assumed then that each chromosome was basically like maybe had SNPs that were different and not much else, if I remember correctly.
That's absolutely right. So our notions of variation were much simpler then.
Yes.
And so this is really how the Genome Reference Consortium got started, was you and I at this meeting listening to the community and their desire to have some place to get these things fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you and I went back to our respective institutions and, you know, started talking to people, started talking to Sanger and WashU and other groups that we thought might be interested in being involved in this. And really tried to develop a system. We were partly able to take advantage because we put so much work into automating the mouse. Mm-hmm. The human actually fit right into that same system.
Yeah.
We then decided that was also some of the things we wanted to do were standardize the process by which we put the genome together. Mm-hmm. So that it wasn't just each center deciding what their rules were. Yeah. That we had a transparent place for people to tell us stuff, that we had a way to communicate to the community. That was really a very rewarding project because I got to work with great people on that project. Now I see Valerie and Tina or Valerie Schneider, who's still at NCBI, and Tina Graves, who gave a talk just last night on work now on this pangenome reference, where
pangenome.
Now we really understand that we need to try and represent population variation within the reference assembly because there is more variation than we really appreciated when the Human Genome Project started.
Yes.
So it's very gratifying for me now that I'm actually not involved with the GRC anymore, but it's gratifying for me to see that group has progressed and thinking about ways they can be innovative and move forward. And, you know, it really ties back to AGBT as well, because it's partly this advanced sequencing technology, the ability to get long reads and to think about, you know, human genome assembly used to be really, really hard.
Yeah.
And in Tina's talk last night, it's hours.
Yeah.
Right? It's really it's a game changer as far as I'm concerned.
It is.
So it's really exciting to see where that's gone.
Yeah. It's mind blowing.
It is mind blowing. But then as offshoots of that, you know, I was also fortunate enough to be involved in other projects around variation. So building structural variation databases, mm-hmm. getting to work with Donna McGlott and Heidi Rehm and Krista Martin to help build the what is now ClinVar, mm-hmm. what used to be kind of a series of various projects. So, you know, that was all really rewarding.
Yeah, so many things.
So many things, yeah.
Okay, and then what made you decide to leave? Or what was your next? What was next? You were at NCBI, and did you stay there the whole time you were, like, were you in NCBI the number of years that you were?
I was at NCBI for 15 years.
It was 15 years.
So it was the whole time I was at NIH. Yeah.
At NIH, yeah. So then what prompted you to move on and leave NIH and go to something completely different?
So it was a couple of things. We had some personal family reasons for wanting to move mm-hmm. closer to the West.
Okay.
But we also, for me personally, you know, I'd been at NCBI for 15 years. Mm-hmm. GRCH 38 was chugging down to come out the door.
Yeah.
So it really felt like a time where things had been finished. Mm-hmm. I could either, you know, kind of stay on and do kind of the same things, or I could look at doing something else.
Yeah, something new.
And it was just really appealing to go try something else.
Yeah,
and so
absolutely.
I went and worked, and this was sort of a natural extension because I had been so involved in ClinVar that I went and began working at the time was a small Mendelian diagnostics company called Personalis.
Yep.
And they had worked on developing a very robust exome, which at the time, I would say they were world leading on their ACE exome, mm-hmm. and really trying to move the clinical diagnostics field to using exomes, trying to move them away from gene panels.
Yes,
effectively
stepping up.
Yeah, really trying, and they had this unique position because they weren't a clinical company that was trying to move into genomics; they were a genomics company that was moving into clinical, mm-hmm. and so they had really good genomic underpinnings from the beginning and maybe were not so encumbered by, you know, old CLIA test or, you know, the things that they already had in.
Right.
And so that was a really great learning experience. Mm-hmm. Got to work with a lot of great people there. But, you know, then the company, you know, and now they're not even really a Mendelian diagnostic company. They've moved more into the cancer space.
Yeah.
And so just seemed a good opportunity to move on as they started doing that. And that's when I went over to 10x Genomics to lead their applications team.
Okay. So Personalis was a good experience, and it was your first jump out of like the public sector into a private company. And then you decided to move on to 10x and lead up their whole applications development team, right?
Yeah.
And how was that?
That was also, I mean, it was a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. You know, the number of applications on that platform, particularly like being there as the single cell revolution really exploded, was just amazing. And it really got me thinking about functional genomics and the fact, you know, we do genetics and genomics because we want to do genotype, phenotype.
Yeah.
And I think the ability in single cell, you know, the single cell omics, I don't even say single cell transcriptomics anymore because it's quite clear from this conference that people need to do multimodal single omics mm-hmm. measurements, mm-hmm. but those are all really nice molecular phenotypes that we can use to really try and understand these genotypes that we're trying to understand.
It's funny to think in that direction.
Yeah. It was a little bit to get my mind wrapped around it as well, but the power is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And so it was the amount that I learned there was just tremendous. Mm-hmm.
What was the most challenging part of it for you?
The most challenging part. So I think the most challenging part was keeping up with the science.
Yeah.
So it was almost it was also the most fun part.
Right.
But it was also a really challenging part because if you think about the ways that people think about doing single cell omics, mm-hmm. it's a wide range of biology. Mm-hmm. You know, it's developmental biology, it's immunology, neurology, and you know, trying to keep track of all of those fields. Like when I was in genomics, even in clinical genomics, I felt like it was hard enough keeping up with the science there, mm-hmm. but at least it was, you know, one thing and it was focused.
Yeah.
Here, I really had to think much more broadly mm-hmm. to start thinking about, oh, well, you know, actually, if I could look at single cell transcriptomes, it would change this space because now they're limited by only doing flow cytometry or CyTOF, and they're missing this piece of information. Mm-hmm. So that was also, but scientifically it was also great, because I think it really made me start thinking more broadly and not just in the genomic space, but how can we use genomics and functional genomics to solve real world problems?
Yes. So cool. When you started at 10X, they were doing the linked read. That was their main thing.
Yeah.
And so how did that transition to single cell, like to only, because, well, at least my interpretation, maybe just because I'm much heavier on the genomic side, was the linked read for technology for genomics, for getting longer reads out of your short reads, or getting longer, you know, information.
Yeah. So, so that's right. And I think, but I, so I think the way to think about it is that even though the linked read genomic part and sort of single cell transcriptomics seem very different, mm-hmm. the basic platform by which you do this is really similar,
okay.
right? Which is that, you know, for linked reads, you would put long molecules into the system mm-hmm. and make droplets with your reagents in them.
Right.
But for the single cell, you know, you're just putting single cells on the system mm-hmm. to make droplets. And there are obviously some chip differences and some minor differences, but it's the basic the platform yeah. and the same concept of what like kind of chemistry that. Can I do in a droplet?
Right. It's all about the droplet.
Exactly. And the reagents that you can get to work in that droplet. I mean, mm-hmm. some of the molecular biologists at 10X are just some of the smartest people that I know, because just because you make something smaller doesn't mean it's always going to work, particularly when you have it in the droplet and there are other things that are going on and mm-hmm. in terms of other chemicals that are there to keeping the coherence of that droplet together. So they were a very amazing team of R&D scientists.
I'm sure. That's awesome. Okay, and then from there, how many years ago did you move on? Was it just like a year ago? I'm trying to remember.
It's been just over a year that okay. I went to Inscripta.
Okay.
And for me, I actually wanted to look, so I was once again trying to look for something where I could continue to learn things.
Yeah.
And the getting into this field of genome writing was really enticing. And so number one, when I was out there talking to people at Inscripta, because it was also intimidating because I'd never done genome editing, so mm-hmm. I knew the concept, but not really very detailed. But the people at Inscripta were so smart and so motivating and also very nice. Mm-hmm. And so I walked out of those interviews actually just feeling excited and invigorated, because the scientific discussions I'd had all day were so cool.
That's exciting.
And it was just, you know, to me now I look at it and I'm just like, well, this is how you can really supercharge understanding the genotype-phenotype problem, because you can now create the variants that you want to study and then put them into your phenotypic assay, as opposed to trying to wait and sample them from natural populations.
Yes.
And so if we really want to supercharge, functional genomics, I think this is going to be a great platform for that. And then since I've been at Inscripta, I've also learned about the sort of power and promise of synthetic biology mm-hmm. and the notion that we can move more towards, you know, production of proteins, amino acids, chemicals in yeast or E. coli, as opposed to in plants or right. in nasty chemical reactions. Right. And so I think that I get personally really excited about things like the sustainability angle, because we are in a climate crisis and this is a big challenge that we face. So I find it personally exciting to be working for a company where our technology can actually try and help us with some of these sustainability challenges.
That's pretty mind-blowing.
It is. And I think keeping up the science here is even harder than it was at 10X.
Because when I, like, you know, since I knew I was going to talk to you today, I looked up the Inscripta website and I don't fully comprehend what you're doing. Like, I have maybe a little bit of an understanding, but it seems like it's really fascinating and interesting, but the science is just moving so fast with all of these things and it's hard to keep up.
It is. I feel like I struggle with that on a daily basis, because, you know, you want to keep up on the technology side, because mm-hmm. in fact, just following the CRISPR technology is hard because mm-hmm. it is changing rapidly. But then there's the application side. If I could generate 10,000 variants in a library, what would I do with that?
Right.
Right. And the possibilities there are just mind-blowing.
Like, what do you do with that?
Well, so, you know, I'll tell you a couple of stories.
That'd be great.
So, you know, one project that I think is actually cool is, and I talked about it in my talk, is work that we're doing with John Stokes, who's a postdoc in Jim Collins' lab at the Broad Institute. Mm-hmm. and they're really interested in studying antibiotic biology. Mm-hmm. And so we're all very concerned about making sure that we have enough antibiotics. And, you know, I think it's really important for us to think about, if we're going to understand antibiotics, we really kind of need the systems level approach to do it, because not only do we need to understand the mechanism by which the antibiotic is working, right? So what is that antibiotic going in and doing to the cell? You know, the cell is in an arms race against that antibiotic. So what tricks does that cell have to now try and combat that antibiotic? So you have to think about studying modes of action as well as modes of resistance. Mm-hmm. And so they're going through and they're making these edited libraries and then applying different antibiotic selections.
So like they're editing E. coli?
They're editing E. coli, and they've done both a series of knockouts, so mm-hmm. they can go in and we can insert a triple stop to try and stop transcription. Mm-hmm. Or we can put in different promoters in front of different genes. So that actually lets us look at essential genes that are not possible to look at in the knockout mechanism, because if you knock them out, the cell dies.
Yes.
And so you can go in and ask, how do these changes affect the cell's ability to respond to this antibiotic? Does it make it more sensitive? Does it make it more tolerant? Does it not do anything? Mm-hmm. And so you can go in now and start identifying parts of the pathway. So even though there are known antibiotics, mm-hmm. we can start getting into other parts of the pathways that might be impacted by these antibiotics. So I think that's pretty cool project.
I work on just in metagenomics, which is quite challenging to actually try to predict phenotype for antibiotic resistance, because you're dealing with these genomes with many different genes and we don't know where they came from. But with long reads, you can start doing a lot more in metagenomics as well. So that'll be interesting to learn more about the mechanisms and what actually has to be present, for example, for it to have resistance, and because it's a very challenging problem in the whole field of genotype to phenotype for antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, and this is where I think the power of the system is, because, you know, when you think about the metagenomics problem, you're sort of sampling the environment and seeing what's there, yeah, and looking for things that you kind of know about. Mm-hmm. And these sets of experiments, they just started going through and looking at genes. Some of them we didn't even know what they do. So there's still, I found this mind blowing that there's still genes in E. coli that we don't know what they
do.
That's
so cool.
And so some of those got knocked out. And, mm-hmm. and one of those actually we saw an effect. We saw changes when we knocked this gene out that we don't know exactly what it does, mm-hmm. when we treat it with gentamicin. And so we can start getting into new biology about this. But now we're not just looking and then trying to make a correlation. We can specifically make a change now and go test it. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, I feel like that's a very powerful paradigm, because we can do precise engineering, precise testing, and then use that cycle to iterate very rapidly.
That's awesome.
I think that's really
cool. Now I have a much better feel for what you're doing.
Okay, awesome.
That's really cool. I think that's going to be super interesting to watch over the next couple of years.
I am very excited about it. We are our first, so right now we work in microbes, but mm-hmm. we're developing a platform for mammalian as well.
Okay.
So I'm very excited about that, because I think about the challenges we face in understanding mammalian biology. Mm-hmm. And I think this platform is just going to be hugely instrumental in helping us try and address those things. Because I think there are also many applications for which we want to go in and make changes in human cells, particularly when you think about, you know, look at ClinVar, right? Like, it's full of variants of unknown significance.
Yeah.
Most of the people in ClinVar were sequenced because they have some genetic disorder or a predisposition for a genetic disorder. Mm-hmm. We find a variant that we think looks interesting, but we don't know that it's actually impacting their disease.
Exactly.
And so to be able to go in and program and test those mm-hmm. specifically to try and get a better sense, I think is going to be hugely powerful.
Yeah. And then things like complex traits are probably, like, things where we just really have never been able to figure out exactly how these things are. We know they're heritable, but we don't really know how.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think GWAS hits are a great example, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we find these associations. We know this region of the genome is impacting this trait, but we don't know. But those GWAS SNPs are very rarely the actual causative SNP.
Yeah.
And so you get all of these SNPs that are in linkage disequilibrium, and not just SNPs, other variants, right? Like, we sometimes forget about the other variants. Mm-hmm. And now we can really go in and test all of the variants, whether we've seen them or not. We can just carpet bomb
that
whole region to start seeing if we can find things that that would impact. And then we can go back and look and see if we've seen those in humans or not. So
that's going to be fun.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
But then this brings to mind to me, how are you handling this on the informatics side? Like, are you, what are you using for this on that side? Are you doing any sort of AI or like the hot stuff or your, the hot terms in the field right now? Or what are you guys doing?
So we are very fortunate. We have both a top-notch computational sciences team because, in fact, there's a lot of basic NGS problems, right? Like, you know, one of the things that we're doing is we're making edits in a population. And so you have a population of cells. Some of those cells are wild type. The edited cells don't all have the same edits. And so you have a, so you first have a variant detection problem, and our assays are largely NGS. So there are some basic NGS challenges because we're not looking, we're not looking for variants that are at a Mendelian ratio now, right? We want to be able to detect a variant, but it might be at a very small fraction of the population. So that's a challenge we're working on because we want to be able to provide assays to people to be able to analyze their data. We're also we are also certainly interested in using, you know, some of the current machine learning AI approaches for the analysis of the data because I think that the scale of the data, you know, we have a data scientist at our company called Richard Fox, who is just, I think, one of the smartest and nicest men I've ever met. And, you know, he'll go through these data sets and from a single experiment, we can generate, you know, 40,000 data points that, you know, we can start to pull patterns out of, but I think being able to take things like machine learning and apply to those data sets is going to be hugely powerful for our customers. Because that's what we really want to do is enable our customers to be able to think about, oh, this is the data I got. Now, what is the next question I can answer so I can go back in and now follow up on this?
So it becomes a visualization problem.
It's a visualization. It's a signal to noise problem as well, because you want to be able to pull out the good stuff. So yeah, but it's a lot. But it's a fun challenge. It's a fun problem to have.
Exactly. Okay. So now what are you thinking for the future, either in the field or for yourself? What are you interested in? I mean, you only changed jobs recently, so you're probably like still pretty in the like honeymoon exciting period. But what are you thinking for?
Yeah, so right now all I'm really what I'm really focusing on is thinking about the platforms we could build at Inscripta to help enable mammalian biology. So that is my focus right now because I look at the microbial platform and I'm excited by what we can do in the microbial platform 100%. And I'm actually trying to work with the microbial applications team on some applications that I think will also be informative for human biology because yeast has long been a really good model system for understanding human biology. But I really want to think about how we can develop a mammalian platform that can really help supercharge. You know, we saw a lot of talks here that all I could think of is like, geez, if we could make some variants and generate some diversity here, we could really shoot this through the roof. So that's really what I'm focused on right now.
That's awesome. I love it. And do you have any advice for people who are early in their career or starting out or maybe just heard about genomics and are interested? Anything to share from your experiences?
Yeah, so I would certainly encourage more people to get into genomics because I certainly think it's an exciting field.
It is.
I think the best way to think about it, I think there's two things that are really important. You know, one of which is to find a good mentor who's going to, you know, give you advice, help, you know, help answer the questions that you may not know, but to also find a good project to work on because I think kind of the best way to really get your head around some of this stuff is to actually dig into the data and actually start doing it.
Exactly. It's so much easier to learn when you're doing.
It really is. And I think that the thing that people should remember is that it doesn't just take a biology skill set now to do this, right? We need people who understand computation. We need mathematicians, right? How many talks have we seen at this conference talking about the need to build a model that we can test against, right?
So many.
We really need a broad range of backgrounds because biology is the ultimate integration problem. And so you need people with different perspectives to actually help solve these problems.
Yes, I love that. That's a great way to put it. All right. Well, thank you, Deanna, so much for doing this with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
For being part of the Genomics Life. And if people want to find you, I'm going to link to your information in the episode notes.
Oh, that sounds great.
All right. Thank you again.
Awesome. Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Thank you again to Deanna for taking the time to sit down with me and be on the podcast. And thank you to everyone who listened. If you like the podcast and haven't already done so, please be sure to subscribe. Thanks. Bye.